It's Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In 2005, Olga Welsh became the dean of Duquesne University's School of Education. Since coming to Pittsburgh, she has been a founding member of the Pittsburgh Promise and served on a number of local boards. Dean Olga Welsh is retiring this year and joins us in studio for another in our series of what we call exit interviews. Olga Welsh, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You came to Pittsburgh when you took this position 11 years ago. Describe what it was like for you, not being from the Steel City, to come to Pittsburgh to take this job and navigate your way through this very unique and sometimes difficult and challenging city, and to be in a position where you're being highly scrutinized at a high-profile university.
I want to say, first of all, that the real challenge for a new leader is to learn your context and not assume that what worked in another context will work in a new one. So the first thing I had to do was to learn about Pittsburgh, and I made it my business to do that. I visited the Heinz History Center, I read, and I also stopped people on the streets of Pittsburgh and asked them. I pointed to Duquesne, and I said, what's that big thing up on the hill there, Duquesne? And they said, that's Duquesne. I said, oh, well, what are they known for? And they told me. They're a wonderful university. They're known for doing good works. They were founded by the Spirit and Fathers, and so on. The other thing that I really tried to do was not to think so much of how I was going to navigate the role. I think you can over-prepare. I came with the expectation of learning. And so I really used as my maxim, you don't know what you don't know. And so as long as you were willing to listen, Pittsburghers were willing to tell you. So I learned about the bridges. I learned about the tunnels. I learned about why the bridges were a certain color. I learned about, yes, this is a town that has a great sports tradition, but it's also a cultural hub. I learned about the universities and what they were known for and how they interacted with one another. I learned that there were neighborhoods and that people were very proud of their neighborhoods, and they talked about those neighborhoods. And I was interested in, so how does one who is leading a school of education operate within multiple contexts? So I saw it almost as a ripple effect of learning, and by learning, hopefully being able to enact the role better.
And how did that help you determine how you would approach your job? So once you had this knowledge, then how did you apply it?
I asked the faculty only one question. I asked the faculty the question when I was a candidate, and I then followed up when I was the dean. And I said, why Duquesne? Why in a state that has 94 teacher education programs, not to mention Ohio, New York, Delaware, Maryland, West Virginia, why Duquesne? What is it that will differentiate this school of education from others? And they looked at me, and I said, right. You must own where we go. Vision does not ride in on a white horse. Vision comes from the bottom up, not the top down. So you're going to have the conversation about the identity of the School of Education at Duquesne. And when you have had that conversation and are ready as a faculty to present it and vote on it, then I'll come in and we'll go from there.
You mentioned before we began this interview that you come from a family in Washington, D.C., that has seven generations of college graduates, of educated people. So as you come into a situation where you're dealing with people from all walks of life who may not have that same background, who may be the first person from their family who is going to college, how does that impact your mindset and your approach?
Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C. My parents were actually from North Carolina and Ohio, respectively. And so the generations I talk about come from both sides of the family. And so one of the things that my family always taught us, and by us I mean my sister and my brother, as well as myself, was that our privilege did not entitle us to think that we were better than others. So one of my father's favorite things to say was, the man who eats out of the trash can and the man who drives a Mercedes-Benz are equally entitled to your respect, not because of what they have, but because of who they are, human beings. So I approached my own privilege from that place, that there was an expectation that I was going to give back. And that came from all the generations that went before.
So as you look back at 11 years at Duquesne and being in charge at the School of Education, how would you define, how would you answer your own question about what sets Duquesne's School of Education apart from the others in our immediate area and in the region?
I think the first thing is that we're part of a Spirit and University, the only Spirit and University in the world. The fact that the Spirit and Fathers had social justice at the center of their work when they came to Pittsburgh in the 1870s, there is where our work begins, within that university context. The second thing is that the School of Education is known for any number of things. It's known for its scholarship. It's known for the most diverse faculty on the bluff across multiple indicators of diversity. It's known for enacting social justice within the context and in partnership with populations of all kinds. So I think what differentiates us is that we're very clear about our identity. Our identity is that we're preparing educational leaders. We are preparing our scholarship for schools so that whether we do basic or applied research, we do that research in order to transform the lives of children and youth in school context and in an ecological way. So our school psychologists, our counselors, our leaders, we're all contributing to the betterment and transformation of the lives of children and youth. And we want to do it within the spirit and tradition of caring. That means we have as our grounding the moral imperative that the Spirit and Fathers instilled in Duquesne University.
Is that missing from just the overall approach to, I know it's hard to generalize, but is that an element that is missing from how we in the United States in 2016 are approaching education and approaching the teaching of young people and how we impart not just knowledge but values?
I think that it's very tempting to overgeneralize. What I think we need to do in the United States is to examine once again why we are educating our children.
Why?
And I'll tell you what I mean by that. When I think of education, I think of education as a means to prepare a citizenry that is able to exercise and understand how its democracy evolved and how to keep it. There has never been a perfect democracy. We know that. But we also know that the way that one can instill and ensure that a democracy is able to survive is through its young people. So it can't just be about acquiring knowledge or acquiring knowledge in order to have a job or acquiring knowledge in order to better myself at the expense of others. It has to be about a nation, a national understanding that we own this country, all of us, and that we have an obligation to help it become better by what we do and by our purposes, multiple purposes. That's what I mean by why educate our children. It isn't that we don't have good values and goals, but I think our young people are not quite sure, once I have it, is it just about me? Is it just about my immediate family or my immediate neighborhood? Now, we had the luxury in the 60s of growing up with a very clear understanding of the obligation to give back. I mean, we had the Peace Corps. I mean, we had civil rights. We had things happening that required our attention. So we were focused nationally at a macro level as well as at the micro level with our own particular lives.
Are we losing that focus now because of, especially for a young person, is it harder not to become self-involved and to have a hard time becoming an altruistic person because you're so wrapped up in your technological devices and your Facebook page and all of these things that tend to just reflect ourselves as opposed to giving us that broader vision of the world?
I think that our young people are not inherently self-absorbed, but I think that the ways in which we have involved them tend to make them more self-aware, more concerned about how they're presenting themselves to the world. We didn't have quite as many distractions. And so we found time to sit down and spaces in which we could have conversations. I remember the breakfast and dinner conversations in my home. We sat down and we talked about things. We disagreed. I don't think that young people are given that luxury. They're moving from one appointment to the other. They're moving from one competition to another. And the space that you need to just be, to just sit, to just talk about something other than yourself, I don't think they have those kinds of opportunities. And I'm saddened by that.
So we're in a time now when people are asking questions and reassessing education and how we approach educating young people on a variety of levels. And I'm sure you've heard a lot about Remake Learning Days and the events that occurred here recently in Pittsburgh. And one of the things that has been discussed is getting away from the rote memorization of facts and figures, which you alluded to earlier, that it's got to be about more than just memorizing and assimilating information. But what has to happen? What needs to be done differently? How do you change the approach to engage children and young people and to meet them on the level they exist on in this day and age?
Well, one of the things we're trying to do with the youth conference, which is part of our Barbara Sizemore Summer Conference, is to get youth to do exactly that. They're helping to plan the conference. They're the ones who decide who the speakers will be and what the focus will be. They design the book bags that are going to be given out to the 170 students who are going to be attending. The idea is, I think young people really do want to engage, but they want to engage with real problems. They don't want us to make up and fabricate activities or exercises or things for them to learn. But I think if we give them a problem, if we give them and we say to them, go into your communities and identify what you believe is a challenge to your own educational advancement, and then we will help you to investigate that. We'll give you the tools to research it. We know the Remake Learning Days were excellent examples of that. There were any number of activities that involved students in hands-on experiences with learning, and they loved it. They couldn't get enough of it. We know that in some settings where you have a whole group of students who are studying a particular issue and they have to bring in science, mathematics, writing, all manner of technology, everything in learning about the problem, walking around the problem from many different places, they're enjoying that. I don't believe our young people are inherently not interested in learning. I think they're not interested in the kind of learning experiences that we're presenting that tend to be much more prescribed and much more delimiting in their scope.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Olga Welsh. She's Dean of Duquesne University School of Education and is retiring this year. She's joining us in studio for an exit interview. And you were talking about engaging students and young people by presenting them with real problems. We live in troubled times. I mean, I think we all are aware of that. And one of the things that I think people worry about is that young people may not be as engaged in the type of activities, for example, that you might have been involved with, that I'm sure you were involved with as a young woman, civil rights, discussions of politics, maybe going out and campaigning for a particular candidate or getting involved with a particular cause. Are we seeing as much of that today? And if not, how do you get students who may not even know the name of their own congressman to get involved?
Well, I think you have to start where they are. I think you can't assume that they don't have the knowledge base. But if they don't, then you have to help them to learn that. When I was in school, we wrote. When I went through college, in the 4 years I was in college, I only saw two objective tests, one in a science course because it was a large course and there were a number of students. And the other was in a course that has sort of identify particular art figures. That was it. Everything else, you had to do gestalt. You had to write. I mean, you get a huge question. It didn't, if you were studying how to deal with hypotheses, you had to talk about the whole historical background behind how syllogisms were developed. If you were talking in a history course, you had to talk about the literature and the individuals who informed what was going on at a particular point in time, not just the dates. I don't think you have to have a foundation, and I think we have to help young people have that foundation. Then we have to teach them how to engage without any gadgets, to really talk about a particular issue or challenge, starting from knowledge, not just, I don't really know, so I'm just going to sort of talk around it. And then we help them build that knowledge base and that foundation slowly, yes, incrementally, yes, and in some ways in actually hands-on experiences, such as the remake learning that you talked about. So you put all of these things together. And the other thing that we have to do, I think, is stand back and give them the space to fail. Because our young people are very much afraid of failure. And we've made them that way.
How so?
Well, because I think that we don't use failure as learning. So if you look at the invention of the light bulb, it took 2,001 tries before the light bulb, Edison perfected the light bulb. And people said, wow, how did you feel about it taking 2,000 times before you got it right? And he said, no, those were 2,000 learning opportunities. And each one of them taught me something that allowed me to eventually succeed with the light bulb. I don't think our young people see it that way. How many of them would have stuck to it for 2,000 quote-unquote failures? And how many of us would have allowed them to stick to it through 2,000 failures? So failure is a learning experience. And to see it as a creative process and to use it to your advantage, I don't think we do that very well.
So how do you apply that practically? How do you give students the room to fail? What do you do? What do you do differently than what's being done today?
Well, I think, for example, you talk about process. So if they're doing a math problem, you don't concentrate so much on the outcome. You have them walk through how they thought about this problem in order to begin to solve it. Where were the gaps? Where did they get stuck? And you have them reflect on that. And you use that as then the basis of saying, all right, so having gotten stuck, then what did you do? And then what did you do? Oh, and you came up with this outcome. So let's see what this outcome is and let's trace it back to the ways in which you thought about it. So you begin to build the schemas in the brain that help people to see, I'm learning all the time. I had never stopped to think about how I learn and the steps I'm taking and the processes that I employ.
As you look back on 11 years at Duquesne School of Education, what do you cite as your biggest accomplishments?
Well, I always say that if you really want to know the impact of a leader, never ask the leader. Leaders always think they're wonderful. Ask the led. They'll tell you. And so I always have invited people who are interviewing, whether for faculty positions or administrative positions or staff positions, to stop anyone. Stop the students in the hallway. Stop the people who are kind enough to take care of our facilities. And then tell them what I've told you and then see what they say. See if, in fact, they support it or say, well, that isn't exactly the way I would I would say that it happened. If you were to ask me what the achievement would be, I hope that I have been able to build a culture that is inviting with the faculty, with the staff, with the students, that invites people to own the School of Education and what happens in it. And therefore, to be very, very careful about who they invite into that culture and the norms that they enforce. And I put enforce in quotation marks. They're very, very, the people in the School of Ed are very much aware of each other and of each other's contributions. The hierarchical relationships are not there. They talk to each other across disciplines, across departments, faculty to staff, staff to students, students to faculty and staff. I think they own the school. So for me, the achievement is to build a culture in which people talk to one another and own it. Or as Lao Tzu says, at the end of the day, if people say we did it ourselves, the leader has achieved.
What advice will you give or have you given your successor?
I've given my successor three briefing books already. She probably has more than she needs, actually. I think she's going to be a very, very wonderful addition to the School of Education. If I would give her any piece of advice, any maxim, it would be the one that I began this interview with. You don't know what you don't know. Learn your context. Listen, or as Shakespeare says, give every man your ear, but few your voice. And be prepared to learn at all times and in all circumstances and from all kinds of people. Because if you do that, then you're never going to grow weary. Or as Confucius says, if you do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Olga Welsh, what a pleasure it's been visiting with you. Olga Welsh is the Dean of Duquesne University School of Education. She's retiring this year and joined us in studio for an exit interview. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESN.